Accession number 13123, Mr. Cyril Mount, Reel 3.
We're talking about your time at the boys' depot, and we'd moved on to when you went on leave.
Yeah.
Now, you've already told us how you wear these spurs and things.
Oh, yes, please.
But tell me about a typical leave. I think you said you went three times.
Yeah, you had like three leaves in that year. So what did I do? I went, what was it, three? No, it was only two, actually. There was a leave at Easter. I went there in January 36. There was a leave at Easter. There was a leave in the summer. And then I finished in the December. There was a leave in the December, that's right. And I was posted.
Now, what would you do on your leave? You went home, I presume.
Each time I went home, yeah, and felt a bit of a sort of hero in the neighbourhood, but I don't think my parents were particularly sort of thrilled. I never got the feeling that they were proud. I wanted them to be proud of me, but I don't think they were somehow. I think they had too many bothers and troubles of their own. My sister was then about 10 or 11, I suppose, and she was giving them a lot of trouble. I think, yeah, she's a bit rebellious and bullshit about things and getting on the wrong side of my father. She wouldn't accept his rigid discipline. So I suppose I was tolerated. But going out in the town, it was nice, you know, sort of, you could make it with the girls, you know.
Would you be in uniform?
Oh, yes, you had to stay in uniform. Couldn't wear civvies.
And that was an advantage with the local
Liverpool. Oh, that was, yeah, that was great, because you had jingly spurs and this riding crop, you know, and the hat cocked on one side. And yeah, it was all right. Lots of little flirtations. But in those days, it was amazing how satisfied you were with just holding hands sometimes in the cinema, you know. That, I didn't have any sexual experience.
Now, so you went on the three leaves. As you were reaching the end of your course, were you assessed in any way? I mean, you mentioned that...
Oh, yes, there was a passing out parade where you... and various sort of tests, you know, whether you knew... You were told to sound various calls at random on the sounding test. That was your main function, to be a trumpeter. I suppose... you'd been continually assessed in your drill and PT and riding abilities. I think it was more a continual assessment. Anyway, you were, you know, very proudly sort of, you know, presented with the cross trumpets, and you very proudly wore them, you know, and you're a big shot then. Then you were posted to different units.
Did you have any sort of, I presume not, but did you have any sort of choice to who you were posted to?
No, you see, I wanted desperately to go to a horse unit. And in the event, I was posted to a mechanized unit that had just come back from Palestine. They had these tracked vehicles. I can't remember what they're called now. They're like sort of tanks with the tops off. And they pulled the guns, which were 18-pounders. And they'd had these in Palestine, and they were all covered with sort of desert colors, you know. And so a lot of the time was spent sort of painting these things.
Now, this was in December 35.
This was December after I went on leave. Oh, I went on leave for Christmas. And then after the leave, I was posted to this place in Catterick Camp in Yorkshire.
And what was the name
called
of the unit?
20th Field Regiment.
How did they sort of welcome you into the unit? Were you just you, or was there a draft?
There were two of us. They had, because we'd been in Palestine on active service, they had not had a trumpeter. I think they'd blown whistles or some bloody thing. I don't know what they'd been doing. So there's myself and this young lad from Somerset.
Remember his name?
I will in a minute. It was on the tip of my tongue. It's just melted away again.
It'll come again.
We were both posted to this 20th field as the trumpeters. What was his name? Anyway, I was very disappointed because they had no horses. But they did. Some of the officers had chargers there. And what I tried to find out ever since was that one of the officers, I think, was the guy who led the Chindits, and his name's escaped me as well.
Wingate.
Wingate, yes. I think Captain Wingate was the Captain Wingate who eventually went to Burma. I'm more than positive it was, because he was artillery as well. And the biggest event, I mean, the rest of Katri camp was pretty meaningless.
Were you attached to a battery?
Yes, I was in a battery, and...
Which battery was it?
Damn if I remember, you know.
We can look it up, but I mean...
Yeah, because I was there such a short time, really, comparatively short time. But this lad, because we just came from the depot, this guy, Wingate, said we could exercise his or horses. And I think I'd express my discontent because of no bloody horses. A lot of the time was spent sort of scraping off this khaki sand-coloured paint, and the vehicles are being repainted the glossy green, you know, the traditional racing green colours. And that's most of what I can remember of this place, and going out on manoeuvres, little exercises on the moors, the heather-covered moors around.
What would your role be in the exercises as a trumpeter?
I was still at sound reveille and mess call and so on, yeah. But I had also to do other jobs, you know, the sort of jobs that people... I remember being part of a gun crew. They deliberately did this. We went up to Northumberland on a manoeuvre, and we were sleeping out on the heather on ground sheets. It was in the summer, and it was quite nice. I just remember very vividly the smell of cordite, because we were firing live rounds in this range, and miles from anywhere, and there were, you know, clear bubbling brooks and the heather, and it was beautiful. And just the smell of heather and the smell of cordite is a big memory I've got of that.
And they put you on a gun crew.
And so they put me on a gun crew.
So you were learning some gun drill.
Learning some gun drill at the time. Yeah.
Do you remember much about the gun drill and the 18-pounder as you were taught then?
I think I swapped around in different numbers.
Do you remember what the number was?
I was an ammunition number to begin with, getting the shells, because the 18-pounder shell is attached to the charge, getting them out of the limber and passing them to the number four, I think. Number three was the gun layer, sitting in the seat. I never did any gun laying, but I remember graduating and being allowed to sort of ram it up the spout, and that was quite thrilling. And the range we were firing on, we could actually see, there was an OP way out, an observation post way out in front, but we could actually see where the shells were landing near these targets, and it was quite thrilling to, you know, hear it go off and then watch and see it explode on that hillside. Anyway.
Did you have any problem with the noise? Because the crack of an 18-pounder can be quite a shock the first time.
No, we were just told to keep our mouths open. When the guy who's laying, he's the one who fires as well, you know. So you get a bit of warning, and you open your mouth. But there's very, very vague memories of that. But the biggest memory of that place was this guy, Wingate, allowing us to take his horses out to exercise. And the second time out, the one I took each time, had an operation that had some breathing problem, and it had a silver tube in its throat. And I was told, on no account must this horse gallop. Well, we went out, this other lad was leading, and we were way out on the moors, and we were cantering quite slowly, and then he decided to sort of split off, and my horse decided to follow, and no matter how much I reined it in, it just went after his horse, top speed. And we leapt a brook, and we got, you know, it was really lovely open country, and suddenly it dropped underneath me. I flew off, and I knew what had happened then before I looked at the bloody horse. It was dead when I got to it. And I, Christ, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was almost, I think I was in tears, really. So I took the saddle. It had a civvy saddle as well, you know. It was a nice, light saddle, luckily, and this bridle bit. Took it all off and took one look at it and kicked it and hoped it would get up, and it wouldn't get up. So I hoofed all the way back about 4 miles or more back to the camp. And I think he'd gone back, and Wingate must have known because he's waiting for me. And without any warning at all, he hit me across the face with his riding crop. And he was absolutely purple with bloody rage. You know. I didn't have a chance to explain what had happened. So I went back, my face was bruised and bleeding, and went back into the barrack room, and I told the lads what had happened. And, oh, fuck's sake, go and report it, bastard, you know, because he wasn't light, he was a really tempestuous mad bugger. Go and report the bastard, go and get him bloody cashier and blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't do that. And so I just sort of, I mean, everybody knew, and yet, because I didn't report it, they couldn't do much about it. And so other people say, what's wrong with your face? Well, it all came up, you know, blue and cut. And I said I'd fallen and caught it on a bed iron or something. And that was it. And he apologised, actually, a few days later. He apologised for hitting me. And then he wants to hear what happened, and I told him. So I was glad I hadn't reported him. But I think it's the same Wingate, Ord Wingate.
You were aware that officers cannot hit other ranks at all?
They're supposed to. No, NCOs are not supposed to hit other ranks. Other ranks are not supposed to hit NCOs. And nobody's supposed to hit anybody in the army, but except you hit each other. But you don't hit a higher rank or a lower rank.
What I mean, you said he was very tempestuous. How did that show itself? Whether it was Ord Wingate or not?
He had this reputation from the Palestine days. He was a sort of daredevil, mad bastard, you know. And so this is what makes me think it's the same guy.
He was in Palestine.
Yeah, so I think it's the same guy. But I've never checked it out. I tried to get a book on his autobiography or biography from the library, and then I gave up. I couldn't get it. There is one. And then I would have been able to check completely whether it was the same guy. But I never followed through.
Did he show it in any other way? I mean, he had a reputation as a mad bastard, but did he do anything else while you were with him that indicated he was a little eccentric or...?
No. He just had a sort of aristocratic sort of disdain. I don't think he got on with his fellow officers, you know, from what I gathered from other people. Because there was a sergeant, a bombardier, he had a little room at the end of our barrack room, and he knew a lot about him from Palestine days. He was the one who tried to get me to report him as well, and I wouldn't. So he said, it was he who told me he wasn't liked by the other officers, and he was one of these what do you call him, a fucking aristocrat who thinks he can do what he likes, you know, something like that. But yeah, he did have a sort of aristocratic sort of demeanour, you know. Sort of.
What about the other officers? What were they? Well, you hadn't seen presumably many officers at the boys' depot.
No, only our Captain Kitcat and the other one who birched me at the time.
What did you think of the officers then? I mean, not sort of what did you think then?
They were gods, really. I think the regular officers, you know, just very superior beings.
Did you look up to them, or was just that what they felt they were?
I suppose we looked up to them, yeah.
Did they come across as good managers of men and competent at artillery and the rest of it?
No, we hardly ever saw them. You know, they'd wander around the gun parks, you know, and we would. All I can remember is the smell of turps and paint and people painting. Oh, I know what I had to do once, because I was good at art. They say, let me do some lettering on the side. Yes, I think it was. I don't know if I had to write 20th Field Regiment or something. Field Brigade, it was in those days, they're called Field Brigades.
What about the NCOs generally that you had to deal with?
Well, everybody was very friendly, because they'd been in action against, well, both the Arabs and the Jews. You know, there's a certain something happens and people are risking their lives, and a few of them had been killed, I think. And so there was an esprit de corps, I think you'd call it that, amongst the mob. You know, that they were friendly, but I was determined to get with horses. So towards the end, and I hated Catterick, I hated the whole thing.
Why? Because you liked the discipline of the boys' depot, or you'd...
Yeah, but I think I was disappointed. I'd had expectations of a more glamorous life than sort of roaring over Northumberland moors in these bloody track vehicles and banging away with 18-pounders. And you know, I wanted more out of it all. And the more I heard about India, the more I thought, well, so I volunteered for India.
Who was telling you about India?
Oh, odd people who'd been in India before the been to Palestine. They're all old sweats, you know, regular.
How did you get on with the old sweats? I mean, did they take? Well, I mean, yeah. Some of them take advantage of you.
As a badgie, they call a trumpeter a badgie. I don't know where that came from either. But as a badgie, you're sort of respected because they know you've done. I mean, they have done 3 months training at the base depot in Woolwich. You've done a whole bloody year, and they know how much the boys are put through it. So there's a certain respect. And then respect because you can blow a trumpet. And I think I got a bit of Bakshi respect because I could draw. I was always drawing. And people would get me to do their portraits to send to the girlfriend, you know.
So it was like a
pay me, yeah. So, yeah.
So they had quite a bit of respect for you. Did they borrow money or that sort of thing?
I've never had any money. But, I mean, my pay went up then to something. Was it 10 bob, I think it was? Or did I have 10 bob and 2 and 6 went home? I can't remember. But I know there's money still. I made an allowance, which was automatically deducted from my pay.
Were you treated as a man? You were 16, 17. Were you treated as a man at that time?
No, I suppose you were still treated as a kid, you know, in a way, but with a certain amount of respect because you'd done a different training.
Would they like take you with them to the pub, that sort of thing? Or?
Oh, yes. I started drinking.
Did you? Were you all right?
Well, but the pub, there were no bloody pubs. And Catterick itself was a dump. I mean, when you went on a weekend, you'd go to Richmond. And, again, you know, the big thing was get pissed and go around looking for a bit of stuff, you know. Which was quite a useless occupation, really.
But you were determined to go. So you volunteered for India, you say?
So I volunteered. I said I wanted to go on a draft to India.
Now, India's got sort of two reputations in the amongst regular soldiers. Mm. One is a terrible place, and another there is this view of it as sort of more glamorous station. Mm. Had you heard of the flies and the heat?
Oh yeah,
and the Borg.
But there was something about I don't know what it was, but there's something about India that really pulled me.
So how did you go about volunteering?
Well, I just had to, I can't remember, I think I had to go to the office and be put through, you know, the battery sergeant major and go through all the channels and eventually see the battery commander and tell him I wanted to transfer, I wanted to go abroad. I did stress that I was disappointed because I wasn't in a horse unit. And there were quite a few horse units still in England in those days, but most of them were in India. Every artillery unit in India was horse-drawn in those days. So that was the main reason, I think, I wanted to use horses.
So there was no problem about being transferred?
No, they just got another trumpeter from the depot, I suppose.
And you were sent out as a trumpeter?
Yeah, and so I was posted then to the 11th Field. I was already assignated to the 11th Field.
A big brigade?
Oh, 11th Field Brigade, as it was in those days, yeah.
And were you given any, before you left, were you given any sort of guide as to what to take with you or, you know, or were you re-equipped with a tropical uniform, khaki drill or whatever?
I think we were issued with a topi, Woolsey topi, and one set of KD, khaki drill, shorts and, what was it, hose tops. Yeah, your hose tops, and then you put a little putty around the bottom. And I went on board, we're down to Aldershot, and it was snow. I went to say goodbye to my parents.
It's been Christmas 36-ish.
It was after Christmas, yeah. Hang on, no, it wasn't. What am I talking about? It was 15th of December when we sailed. It was before Christmas. And
that's 1936 still.
36, yes. And we went to see Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. And they put it on telly recently, I forgot what it's called. Anyway, we went to see this in the cinema in Liverpool, and I said goodbye to them, got on the train, and went down to Aldershot. And from Aldershot, we drove in lorries in the snow down to Southampton.
Was this all a draft for the 11th, or was this a draft
just
for India?
No, it was a general draft for India. And I got on board Her Majesty's Troop Ship. Somersetshire. at Southampton.
And yeah. What were conditions like on what deck were you on?
Well, I was. This was so funny. I was packed down below with what seemed like hundreds of other people, with a greasy sort of table and hammock slung across the table, and I was allocated a hammock, and that was it. Then a message came down that I was to report up to the top. I've forgotten who it was, a Bess or a quartermaster or something. And I was told that I was to be the ship's bugler. And I was then given a room on the normal deck with about three or four other people, with a sort of bunk. And it was totally different. And so I had to blow. Oh, God, here's a bugle. And I had to blow infantry, fall in, sort of get on parade. I can't remember where I went now. Somebody sort of hummed it to me and I blew it. Because there were infantry with us. And I said, what the hell, you know. So some of the infantry calls we had picked up, you know. So it was mainly a case of fall in and of course an alarm, if I've forgotten how that went. Oh yeah, there's a stranger in the camp. That's the alarm. If you know, if the boat was sinking, I suppose. Boat stations. So I sounded this, and then I think some like last post was sounded. A lot of people on the quayside, all sort of tearful, waving goodbye. And I blew something anyway, and or dismiss or something. You know. And I went down below and went to my room. I think we got around the corner. I think the channel wasn't too bad. I was starting to feel sick. But when we got round the corner, Finisterre and into the bay, it was really rolling. And I was so sick, I threw up over the side, and then I went down a flight of stairs, thinking somehow that if I got the lower I got, the less it would be moving, you see, with me bloody bugle. And I finished up in a room full of canvas and the most awful stench. It must have been near the bilge. And this room was full of great reams of canvas. And I just crashed down on this canvas, still throwing up green bile, and I passed out. And I was picked up. Apparently, everybody had been looking for me. And I was found by a sailor who had just accidentally gone into this locker room, where it was. And, you know, luckily, because it was dark as well, luckily he'd found me or heard me groaning or something. And so I was carted up and put in sick bay. By the time I came out of there, we were round the corner into the med. And everything was sunny and beautiful. And I had quite a fuss made of me because I sort of nearly died or something, you know. And I dehydrated or something like that. You know. So from then on, life was absolute bliss. You know, people were playing all the tunes from that Fred Astaire film on the wind-up gramophone on deck. And I was allowed up on the officer's deck because I had the sound up there as well as down below. And it was bliss. So I just sailed through the Mediterranean. We stopped at Malta, and then we stopped at Portside. And all the kids.
What were your first your first time overseas, foreign countries?
It was magic. Absolute magic, yeah, because I always have been, you know, impressed by the visual side of things, and there's so many things to see. It's all so exciting, you know, put aside with little Arab kids diving in the water for hot pennies, you know, they're actually making pennies hot down below and then coming up and throwing them and they sizzle through the water and the kids would dive for them.
Did you try and get any of it down?
I did drawings. I did lots of little drawings at the time. I drew rather than wrote things. I wrote home, I suppose, but you know, I never kept a deliberate diary. And then through the Red Sea and eventually Karachi. But you know, I've still got the most incredibly sharp memories of these tunes. If I ever hear those by the Adriatic water. Let's face the music and dance. You know that, and lots of songs like that always remind me now of that. The deck and the sunshine and the smells and.
Did you feel that was the excitement you'd been looking for?
I thought I was going towards what I wanted. Yes, and then. When we got to Karachi and people...
Had you been ashore anywhere on the way out yourself?
No, we didn't go into that
So you'd
shore.
Seen the sights?
We'd seen it all, yeah. We stayed in Port Said about a couple of days, I think.
But you hadn't been ashore
but
to see?
Nobody went ashore. I think the officers went ashore.
Because these places aren't as nice as they look, I understand.
Oh, no. But I think they were in those days. Because I've been to Port Said recently, last year. And I went to Egypt, went back. But it's not the same, no.
So what about getting to Karachi? What were your first impressions? If you could tell us in as much as you remember, the sight, sound, smell.
I remember going through the Red Sea. I remember, again, listening to this music, which seemed to be playing continually in this wind-up gramophone, and standing at the back of the boat and watching fish leaping out of the water, phosphorus fish, and the waves, the wake of the ship all glittering. It was pure magic, and the stars... You know, so close you could almost touch them, because it was all dark. You know.
What about when you got to Karachi itself?
Karachi was just, we didn't see much of it, because it was just a teeming mass of humanity. And we were all split up at that point, and people went off in different directions, of Northwest Frontier and Rawalpindi and down south. And I got on a train with, I can't remember how many other people, dozen or so maybe, and the posting orders must have been there, or maybe they were there from the beginning, I don't remember. Maybe they were waiting for us at Karachi, because there were military people sort of supervising all this. And I went straight to a place called Barili, and that was a battery outpost from the four batteries in the 11th, the 84th battery. Field battery was stationed in Barili.
How do you spell that? Do you know?
Barilly. And that was in what is now Uttar Pradesh, but in those days it was called the United Provinces, UP. And
what about the train journey there? Because the Indian train journeys are quite memorable.
I can't actually remember that train journey, but
we'll
generally train journeys, yes, they are memorable, because they were puffer trains, steam trains, and as you turned a bend, there were lots of bends in the track, and when you turned around a bend, all the ash and black smoke would fill the compartment, because there were no glass on the windows, there were just bars on the windows, so everybody finished up with black faces and grit in their eyes. We finished up very dirty after, God knows, quite a long journey, really.
So you went to Barili, and that's where you joined the 84th Battery, 11th Field
that's
Brigade.
Right. Yeah.
How did they what sort of reception did you get from them?
Oh, it was great. Great, yeah.
In what way?
Very welcome. Well, I think they'd, the guy I took over from had been an Anglo-Indian trumpeter, and although there was a training depot in India, and the one before that had been Anglo-Indian. And so I was the first trumpeter that had been trained in England. And I suppose they appreciated that I'd a young trumpeter straight from England. But yeah, I was a very friendly battery, it was a small unit. And there were...
The whole battery was there, wasn't it?
It was just the whole battery, four guns, yeah.
Were you at the headquarters as a trumpeter, or would you be with a troop?
I was the how many bungalows? Three bungalows. Gun teams lived in two bungalows, and the bungalows were amazing. They were rather sort of classical, almost Greek, with the steps going up and sort of a centerpiece with pilasters and sort of pseudo Greek columns and a sort of architrave, They're quite big, and they had punkers that just swung backwards and forwards to move the air. They didn't have fans in those days.